Celebrating 40 years of music and ideas, 91.3 KBCS, a listener-supported public service of Bellevue College. You're about to listen to a segment of our program, Music and Ideas, hosted by Sonia Green.
Fiddleheads, huckleberries, nettle, these are all ingredients we see more of on locavore restaurant menus these days, and they're all wild foods, ones that aren't grown in rows but only found in our wild Northwest setting. Spurred by the local food movement, more people are getting out to forage for these ingredients, and some do this to enjoy fresh local foods or for the novelty or to stretch their legs. Whatever the reason, this brings about a conversation about how we relate to our food and the environment that it comes from. With me today in the studio is Valerie Seacrest. She's an enrolled member of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe and works as nutritionist and native foods educator, right, for the Northwest Indian College's Cooperative Extension Department. Welcome to the show, Valerie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also, I have on the phone with me Jenny Hahn. She's the author of Pacific Feast and Spirited Waters, Soloing South Through the Inside Passage, expeditionist and educator on wild foods in our region. Welcome, Jenny.
Oh, hello, Sonia.
Well, I am
and
so,
Valerie.
Yes. So glad to have both of you in to talk about this. I know there are a lot of issues around wild foods also that we want to address. So, Valerie, I'm going to start with you. What are some of the food issues that the tribes are faced with now, and how are the tribes trying to work through them?
For tribal communities, we have many barriers to accessing traditional foods, which, you know, right now we're dealing with health epidemics like diabetes and heart disease as a result of a superimposed diet on our communities, where huckleberries, nettles, and fiddleheads, along with, of course, salmon and elk, were at the core of a Coast Salish diet traditionally. And now accessing those foods, you know, in a modern world, we've got a loss of land, a loss of treaty rights, environmental toxins. You know, we live in a modern world with a modern lifestyle where you have to have vacation time to go out and harvest those things and then the money to put in your gas tank to go get them. There are many, many challenges, and a lot of tribal communities are working to really overcome those barriers.
And what are some of the ways that they're working? I mean, can you give me an example of some of the ways that they're overcoming those barriers?
Sure, yeah, we're revitalizing. I coordinate the Muckleshoot Food Sovereignty Project, which we started about 4 years ago, and it's all about revitalizing our traditional foods diets and increasing access to those foods through creating educational gardens and planting more of our traditional foods right outside of our doors and taking people out and showing them how to harvest and access and cook and prepare those foods. So it's about discussion and workshops and education, but it's also about just defining our own diets and our inherent right to have that access to those foods.
And Native Americans, I mean, culturally, you know, harvesting food is kind of something that definitely culturally seems to be something that Native Americans are very proficient and, you know, and know how to do very well. So in kind of getting back to the education piece of it, is that something that also kind of ties in with the heritage piece? And is that something that maybe for a new generation, if you will, of Native Americans, you know, how do they embrace that, or, you know, how is that kind of taught to them in terms of what that might look like from a cultural perspective?
Yeah, well, what I see happening, you know, time and time again, every time somebody gets out there and starts harvesting their plants and foods, they start to remember teachings. They remember teachings about the way their grandmother used to use this food or the name of it. And that in and of itself is medicine, remembering who we are and where we come from. And that's what our foods have to offer for us. They're about identity. They're a living legacy. They're, you know, our ancient community gardens. It's not that new of an idea. We've been actually maintaining these wild spaces for a very, very long time. And it's just been a brief part of our history where people were removed from that. And even in that time, people were still accessing those foods. So it's about identity and those foods as our teachers.
And there's also a component of spirituality as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, when you're in For the Coast Salish people, we consider the plants and the foods more than a commodity. They're our greatest teachers, and they teach us how to behave in the world. So, you know, we talk about the plants, the plant people, as the first people that were put here before the fish and the salmon and the seafood and the game and us humans, and they were put here to take root and to live their life as a teaching for those to come in the future. And so we look at the plant people and ask ourselves how we might live like the cedar tree does, you know, standing among a diversity of other trees against the fiercest storms and holding the world together, how we might live our life like that, or how the salmon return to their ancestral rivers every single year and give their life to the land and to the animals and to us humans in this commitment of life eternal, and how we might also live our life in that way. And in that way, it's very spiritual. We're inextricably intertwined with our environment. And when people can cultivate that relationship again, it's very reciprocal and it's very healing.
And it's very beautiful. Yeah. How did you get involved in working with Wild Foods?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to come to you next, though, Jenny. I'm going to give this to Valerie, and then I'm going to come to you with the same question.
It's funny because Jenny is actually part of this story.
Better.
I used to work for the elders in Muckleshoot, and I was a caretaker there. And so I spent my days taking elders to doctor's appointments, and I'd ask them, you know, what you think you really needed to heal. And time again, they would talk to me about traditional foods and how important those foods were. And so I decided to go to school and study nutrition and really get a grounding in a really allopathic world, you know, about how those foods affect our body and how food is medicine. And so I went to school at Bastyr University, but then in my last quarter, Jennifer Hahn strolled in the door and started talking about Wild Foods. And I'd had a class with another teacher, Jennifer Adler, who also talks a lot about Wild Foods. And I remember spending, you know, 2 years there thinking, how am I ever going to go back to my community and talk about biochemistry and all these things? Where is the cultural context? And I think if it weren't for that introduction that Jenny gave and the weaving that in with the teachings that my elders had sent me off to school for, then I would have never gotten on the Wild Food Parade. But I'm so happy that this relationship has been cultivated.
Okay, well, we're talking to Valerie Segrest. She's an enrolled member of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe, and she works as the community nutritionist and native foods educator for the Northwest Indian College's Cooperative Extension Department. We're talking about Wild Foods, and also on the phone with us, Jenny Hahn, who we just heard a story, obviously inspired Valerie on her path with Wild Foods. So why don't you tell me a little bit about how you got into Wild Foods, Jenny?
Well, first of all, every time I hear Valerie speak, I just about fall into tears because it strikes my heart so much to the center. And how did I get involved in Wild Foods? You know, oftentimes stories like this take root when you're pretty small and you don't even know they're taking root. And it's like mushroom mycelium. They live there for years and years, and suddenly they sprout fruit. And you realize that these influences for me went back to when I was maybe 8 years of age, and my father would take us camping all around the country in the summers, and we'd eat the local food. That means we would pick the berries and catch the trout and talk to the locals about how to dig razor clams and how to cook them. And with time, a wonderful old world forager, a woman named it's Mrs. Engelbritzen, she took me out and said, "The slippery jacks are out. Do you want to come out and find them with me?" And I was, again, only 8 years of age in a little cottage kind of summer home up in Wisconsin. And we went out to find these mushrooms, and she peeled the slippery tops off and took the meat and sauteed it in, back then it was oleo or margarine, put it on Wonder Bread, and I thought, this is great. So Florence was one of these women from old world Europe who knew these things. And with time, I came to Washington and I loved to be outside on long trips and kayaking. I found myself going up the Inside Passage and harvesting a number of seaweeds and sea urchins and other things that I had learned about when I was in college. And with time, I fell so much in love with these things because they sustained me, not just physically, but at a much deeper level, very much what Valerie talks about. You're just aware there's a transfer of one life to another and from one being to another, and you owe tremendous gratitude day after day to this complex and beautiful world that's been there for thousands of years that continues to sustain you.
Well, and speaking of sustainability, can you give me an example of how people can forage sustainably? I mean, obviously, it is something that has been done for, you know, years and years and years. So what can people do if they're, you know, just approaching it? How can they make it sustainable?
I think it's very important to, first of all, find teachers and organizations that already have some systems in place for you to learn. For instance, Native Plant Society. There are Native Plant Societies all over the state, and you can become a member for $15, and then you can belong to one other society at the same time. And society may sound highfalutin to some people, but what it is it's a group of people that love native plants that want to see them thrive and help restore habitats that have native plants, and they learn about them together on field trips, through lectures every month at meetings. The same is true of a mycological society, a mushroom society. So there's the Puget Sound Mycological Society, wonderful organization for people to go on field trips and learn how to harvest in a way that protects the species so it's there for generations to come. I wrote Pacific Feast in part very much with that in mind, to teach people some guidelines for harvesting, for instance, seaweeds and mushrooms and nettles and, oh goodness, berries. But I think what's very important is that people understand that all of these things that we put on our plate have had a relationship with hundreds of other species that live in their area. For instance, there are times when you might go up to a national forest to harvest huckleberries, and you should always stop at the Forest Service station, talk to the ranger, get a permit. It's free, and they will tell you how much you can harvest because they're kind of keeping track of all the foragers going into these places. And I'm not talking a commercial forager, but someone just like you or me or Valerie that might be going to pick in a national forest for berries, for jam, for instance. So I would stop in one of these places, ask for a permit, and sometimes I've been told, you know, the huckleberry season is very bad this year. There aren't many berries because there's been a drought, and we are asking people not to pick huckles because the bears and the migratory birds are in such dire need of that food to survive. So when you go through these channels of people that know a little bit more, they have their, you know, finger on the pulse of the health of the ecosystem, you can pick sustainably just by going through the right people, at the gatekeepers. You know, because for thousands of years, you know, probably 9,700 years ago up in Namu, which is a tiny town up the BC coast, they still have the archaeological sites and middens where people obviously were clamming and doing other things just like we do today, except that it was almost 10,000 years ago as the ice was retreating or had just retreated. And so what I'm thinking when I pick is, how could these things be here given ocean acidification, given the introduction of invasive species, given the loss of habitats, given the loss of wisdom about how to harvest them? How can we now enter in relationship with them again so they can be here for thousands of years, given all the challenges? And how can we continue this incredibly sacred alliance that has been there and been set forth for us by people like the Muckleshoots?
Well, speaking of guidelines, what kind of wild foods are out right now as it gets colder? And then are there any foods, like, you know, like you mentioned, seasonal, something, you know, the huckleberry being maybe a seasonal thing. So what are some things that people would be looking for right now and then maybe later on as you start approaching the spring?
Well, right now, the mushroom season is, we're in the peak of it. Our mushroom season here in the Northwest goes from late September to November. So we are right in early October, and the chanterelle mushrooms are, this is one of the biggest, most, what do I want to say, they call it a flush, one of the biggest flushes in the Northwest of chanterelles in a long time. And with the chanterelle, I just want to point out that chanterelles live, on average, 45 days. The fruiting body that comes above the ground, the beautiful golden goblet that people pluck, lives for 45 days on average, 90 days or more. And so it's very important when people pick these that they do two things. One is they don't stomp around on the ground, because when you are walking around on wet ground picking chanterelles, even just normal footprints, they compact the soil, and mycelium of chanterelles loves oxygen. It needs little pockets of oxygen all around these long little invisible threads that are underneath your foot. And so you don't want to pack them down by going to the patch again and again and again. You want to be wait until they're, you know, about an inch and a half or more in cap width, and then pick them so they've had chances to put out their spores too. So chanterelles are a big one. As soon as the low tides come at night, this is a great time for razor clams on the sandy open beaches of Washington. On the rocky gravel beaches like Birch Bay State Park, all the way down through the straits, like the Strait of Juan de Fuca, little neck clams for bouillabaisse, butterneck clams, horse clams, all the clams in general were dug more often in the wintertime because they were dug at night. They were dug when there wasn't much problem with paralytic shellfish poison, which can happen in the summer months. So this is clamming season coming up, except that you're going to be digging at night. But that's exciting. Meanwhile, big storms are going to be coming into the strait, up Rosario Strait, into other places where we live along the coast, and bullwhip kelp stems are going to be floating free and washed up on the beaches, and bullwhip kelp makes a fabulous chutney, pickles. It's just a great salsa ingredient, too, but you always want to pick it where it's a clean environment, where there is no industry nearby. You want to get firm tubes that look evenly gold and hard all the way up and down. Turkish towel seaweed that looks like a nubby maroon washcloth is a wonderful seaweed to use as a thickener to make something like chocolate ocean pudding that you kind of simmer it
chocolate
in.
Chocolate ocean hazel pudding. Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
it sounds really good, yes. Well, you obviously there's lots of things that people can still be picking this time of year. I wish we could continue to talk about them all, but we're kind of running out of time, and I want to give you both an opportunity to give some advice to people who may want to try foraging, or maybe they've started already, but they don't quite have some of these tips that you've kind of put out there, Jenny and Valerie, especially as it relates to sustainability or, you know, maybe watching the time of year you're picking or how much you're picking. So, Jenny, I'll come back to you for that, and then Valerie, I'll let you wrap it up. Or you can go first.
Okay. Well, I would just urge people to think of it like as if it were a community garden, because it is. They're spaces in the wild that have been maintained and managed, like Jenny was saying, you know, 9,000 years. We know that salmon has been used here for sure for 10,000 years. And so when you're entering those wild spaces, to think of them, you know, they don't look like Mr. McGregor's garden, but they certainly are. People have been maintaining them, and it's something that we've inherited from a long line of living people who had developed a really rich relationship with the land. And so would you just enter a community garden and leave it a mess, or would you want to get to know the people of that place and the meaning of that place? And I think that story of the land is so much, is so worthwhile, and it's so rich. That's the wealth we all carry. So, and we obviously live in a very abundant food system here in the Northwest. I'd also encourage people to remember that as we are, you know, we're experiencing this good food movement where people are growing more farmers and ranchers, and community gardens are coming up everywhere. And those are all really awesome, wonderful things, but to also remember our natural resources here and the taste of the place and how that really defines us as a culture in the Northwest. And you know, for tribal communities, it's who we are. It is who we are made of. So, yeah.
That's great. Okay, well, Jenny, what would you add to that?
I think, first of all, don't jump in and just collect willy-nilly. You should not only know how to properly identify things, but what the relationships are with that particular food that you're picking, along with all the other things. For instance, you know, chanterelles have a relationship with a tree, and they help feed that tree from a vast network of almost like conveyor belt-like mycelium threads that go out almost 7-plus times that the tree roots could expand. So the chanterelle is a friend of the tree, and the tree is a friend of the chanterelle. You don't want to pick them all. There's a relationship there.
And Jenny, I hate to cut you off, but I'm so running out of time. I'm going to have to wrap
fine.
It up. But I really appreciate Jenny, you being on the phone with us to talk about wild foods, and Valerie coming in the studio. We'll have more on our website, more information. Our website is kbcs.fm. Thank you again, ladies, for your time.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Music and Ideas here on KBCS 91.3.